knowing the difference between work and fun is really important to me and is something that I've had to come to grips with the whole like, well, it's just an extra 5 minutes. I don't need to charge an extra 5 minutes. I'm like, no, 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 no. You charge the extra 5 minutes.
You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folks who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. Today's guest is storyboard artist and production coordinator, Ashley Lamb. Ashley has worked for studios like Stupid Buddy, Joe Murray Studios, and Walt Disney Animation, which means she's worked in both TV and feature. And even more than that, she's worked as a production assistant and coordinator, as well as a storyboard revisionist. In our conversation, she shares how she navigates both avenues within animation, how she cultivated management skills as she was promoted from assistant to coordinator, what she's aiming for in the future, and how she plans to get there. Please note that this interview was recorded in fall of 2020. So grab a beverage of your choice, sketch while you listen if you like, and enjoy.
Hi, I'm Ashley Lamb, and I'm a production coordinator at Walt Disney Animation Studios that's really into stories that have a little bit of magic in the everyday and are modern or updated retellings of familiar stories.
Wow, I love that intro.
I wrote everything out for you. I'm so excited.
I love that. So prepared. So that's awesome. I can't wait to get into everything I want to get into with you. And I'm so excited to have you on the podcast because I've loved you for many moons and you're a delight.
No, I'm excited to finally be here because like before we even met, I listened to this podcast before I was ever even in the industry. So it's just like, oh, I love how this is just coming around.
Oh my gosh. I love that so much. Okay. So let's rewind. What is your origin story? Like, when did you know you wanted to work in animation?
It was kind of like a two-part process. The first part was when I was about like 6 or 7 years old, and I was watching the Aladdin VHS, and at the end they had this like behind-the-scenes featurette where they had Eric Goldberg animating the genie, and he was doing that flippy thing with all the papers between your fingers. Yes. And I was just like, oh my god, these are drawings, and I love to draw, so I thought I wanted to be an animator. But as I grew up, I kind of like forgot about that. And I was just like focused on being like a super cool kid, which I totally was not. And then the second time around was when I was out here in LA and I was working in live action on a game show that was like totally breaking my soul. And I was out on a run and a show on NPR came on and said, do you not know what you want to do for your career? I'm like, no. What's going on, NPR? Do you have the secret key to what I should be doing with my life? Because what I'm doing now, this ain't it. And they said, you should look to what you did for fun as a kid. And for me, that was drawing like one page comic panels of like my own headcanon or fan fiction of my favorite animated movies. And looking back at that as an adult, it was like, oh, that's actually storyboarding. So that's how I fell back in love with animation.
I love that. So when you had this moment of clarity, like, did you face any obstacles and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, the first one was that I was in live action with no connections to animation. So it was just like, how do I even begin to broach the industry? And what I got into doing is that when you're a PA in live action, you are one of the most quote unquote interesting people on set because no one wants to be a live action PA forever. And so people would ask me, what do you really want to do? And most people would say like, oh, I want to be like a DP or a gaffer or a director. And for me, it was always that I wanted to work in animation. And the people who cared enough to actually listen and to refer me or their friends to me just slowly helped me connect some dots and get me hooked up with some people so we could talk. And yeah, that was just the biggest thing. Another one was just facing the realization that my dreams were changing. And that was the scariest thing, because I went to school for photography, actually. And then in my senior year, I realized I really don't want to do photography. I want to do film. So it was like the struggle of realizing I had just sunk thousands and thousands of dollars and years into this degree that I'm not going to use. But the dream of wanting to work in entertainment was so strong that it was like, well, let's go ahead and just ignore that sunk cost fallacy and let's just go ahead and dive in. And then when I got into LLA and started working in live action, it was not what I thought it would be. And like my dreams were changing again. It's like, what have I done? I moved across the country. I've wasted what I thought was wasted more years sinking it into this thing. And now it's changing again. What am I doing?
Yeah, I can only imagine like, okay, here's my question. So I feel like, especially when we're young, like we have a hard time coming to grips that our dream is changing or evolving or that we might need to pivot. Mm-hmm. Like, did you have any emotional turmoil there, or were you pretty flexible with your evolution?
It was terrifying because like all these big decisions that I was like hinging on these dreams that I didn't know what it would take to achieve or even to just like insert myself into the industry. And it's really terrifying just, you know, having all your hopes and dreams and time and money invested in something that's not turning out. And then especially when it happens to you twice within like 5 years, it was just like a freaking nightmare because do I even know what I want anymore? Should I just move back to St. Louis and just like hunker down and be cool with, you know, giving up on something I worked really hard on? Yeah. So it was absolutely terrifying.
Mm-hmm. And it sounded like you had mentioned like networking and asking for referrals or mm-hmm. like people referring you. Mm-hmm. Like, do you have any tips on networking? Like, it seems like you're probably a really good networker.
I think I'm okay. I'm terrible at small talk. So it's just, I'm very blunt with what I'm looking for. but because of that, when people, you know, even if they were intending for it to be small chit chat, it's like, oh, hey, what's your name? My name's Ashley. I'm a PA here. It's like, oh, that's cool. Well, what is it that you really want to do? And they're thinking like, I'm going to say, oh, I want to be like a camera assistant or something. It's like, I want to work in feature animation, specifically on musicals. And they were like, whoa, okay, super specific. And either the conversation would die right there. And I'm totally cool with like just murdering conversations like that.
Yeah.
Or they would be like really intrigued and we would talk further about it. And so it's just like, I'll cling to those people. But yeah, I'm so blunt that if I kill something, it's okay.
That's good that you're just cool with it.
Yeah. So it's just like, just come out with it, with what you're looking for, but also like, you know, act like a human. Be like, mm-hmm. Oh, hey, how are you? That's cool. I see that you know something about animation or are related. Can I like pick your brain about this? And blah, blah, blah. So it's just like, pose it as a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Did you use any other resources to help you break into the industry?
Yes. At the time when I was trying to get in around like 2013-15, I was relying heavily, heavily on Twitter because I had Twitter for a while, but I never really used it until I started taking a few classes at CGMA and at the Guild, and people started talking about some artists and they were like, oh yeah, I saw on their Twitter, blah, 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 blah. And so I finally got on and started following people. And then that's where I learned like the pulse of the industry, where I started to get to know, not necessarily personalities, but just like the flow and the thoughts of the people that were in the industry. And they would post their art and they would retweet other people's art and I would follow it because I thought it was cool. Or if I liked the title that they had, like, what's a color designer? I have no idea. Let me go ahead and follow them and see what it is that they do. And then it's not my network, but just like my Twitter just exploded with animation. And that's how I learned the difference between like TV and feature storyboarding. There's this program called Storyboard Pro. I should probably look into that. And it really helped me expand my knowledge because I didn't study animation in school. I took like one animation class. So this was just like a whole new world for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so nervous when I'm on Twitter. I'm like, I'm going to say something wrong and get roasted. But like, I love following your Twitter. You're just so conversational. And it makes me feel like I could do it too. Because I'm like, oh, Ashley's such a good person. And she does these fun things. And you put opinions out there too, of course. But
I think it's because I know that I have a very small following of like less than 400 people, and probably half of them are bots or just like inactive accounts. So it's like I'm literally talking to 3 actual humans that have ever met me in real life. So I'm just going to go ahead and talk to you, Cassie, or I'm going to talk to Belle, or I'm going to talk to Katrin. It's like, that's about it.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, so how did you finally break into the industry?
So it was the summer of 2013 when I decided I wanted to pivot into animation, and it wasn't until about February, March 2016 that I actually broke in, because this entire time I've been telling people that like I want to get into animation and I'm meeting with people and they're trying to like let me meet people, but nothing ever really came of it. Even though I had a few interviews here and there, they just like said I didn't have enough experience, or it's just like wasn't the right fit. But I was working on another game show. I did a lot of game shows in which one of my fellow PAs, her husband was working at a stop motion studio and was in charge of operations, and he needed to hire a new runner. And being a runner for that studio was basically the same thing as being a live action PA. And so she referred my resume over to him and they interviewed me. And while I didn't get it because they thought I was too overqualified, the person who did get it unfortunately didn't work out. But for me, that meant I got to slide right in. So I just spent like the first 6 months of my career in animation, like refilling Crafty in the kitchen and restocking toilet paper. It was great.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. So how are you able, like, so I didn't know that you started as a runner. That is so interesting. I didn't know that, you know, like in offices, like some titles change per just the group of people that decide what that role will be. Because I think at ours, our office coordinator does those things. So it's just very interesting to hear that, you know, that's a position. Yeah, that's so cool. But of course, your ambition is like bigger than just being the runner for the studio. So like, how were you able to advocate for yourself to move into, I think you were a PA there, right? Like, how did you, how were you able to advocate for yourself to make that transition?
It was like a lot of sort of unconscious advocating, like doing the work before I actually applied, because I always come in, I'm known as the happy one. Like all of my other live action production managers may forget my name, but then someone will remind them, it's like, oh, Ashley, the happy one. It's like, oh yeah, we'll take her. So I continued being the happy one, even though, you know, I was elbows deep in soda that had exploded and spilled all over the studio kitchen or something. And when the opportunity came that a PA for a show had rolled off, that I went to the production managers and was like, hey, I would really like the opportunity to interview for this. I've been a PA for years and years now. I've also worked in offices in live action, and I feel like I'd really be able to make the transition. And because I had demonstrated a good attitude and a hardworking demeanor in what is a very physical job, I feel like that really helped set me up, because I was already seen in a positive light with them.
That's very cool. Yeah, I think it's like, I don't know, I've worked on a lot of production teams, and it's so easy to fall into like this sour like mood just because like there's so many deadlines and there's so much happening every day and it changes daily. But like it's really amazing that you're able to keep such a positive attitude through like all of this kind of thing. Do you have any tips? Because I know I'm definitely at fault of being, you know, having like a down day.
For me, I'm just naturally a really resilient person, and I'm always looking forward to tomorrow, because I've kind of embraced this, the fact that time is ever flowing, and no matter how hard I will try to stop it, it's going to go on without me. So I can either try to swim against the tide, or I can go with it and have like a really fun ride. So even if I'm having a really terrible day, I just take comfort in knowing, like, if it's a terrible day at work, well, in a few hours, I'm going to be home, and home is my safe spot. I can leave the troubles I had at work there, or if I'm having trouble at home for whatever reason, it's just like, well, I can just power through this and try to make it better. Everything that is within my power to do, I try really hard to do it, because then if nothing changed despite my efforts, then it's like, well, it was inevitable anyways. So just go ahead, embrace it, move on. I may have like a new broken bone, but you know what? That's cool. I look sweeter with this cast on my arm.
I love it. Oh, that's so good. Not that you had a cast on your arm in this, you know, imaginary realm, but although I have this next question, I'm going to ask you another question about Stupid Buddy. Mm-hmm. Were you a storyboard revisionist there?
Yeah, I actually went from studio runner to PA to coordinator to storyboard revisionist, all in one studio.
That's nuts. And it was in like a very short time frame, right?
Yeah, so I was there for less than 2 years, and about every 6 months, I was getting myself promoted.
That's so cool. So, like, they probably just couldn't get enough of your really good attitude, right?
I like to think so. No one's ever explicitly said, like, we're going to move you here because you have a great attitude. I think it was just more of the setting myself up for success in that keeping up a really good attitude when, like, things got really tough, you know, just powering through all the troubles we were going through and still being very vocal in what I was aiming to do. Like, I wanted to go work on a 2D show because I haven't worked on the 2D branch. So I went ahead and did that. And then they had an opportunity for a coordinator and they said, well, do you want to go ahead and try this? You seem pretty competent at this. I'm like, oh, heck yeah, I'll try that. And my AP on that show was like, well, we're winding down on the show and I know another 2D show at the studio is needing a revisionist. Let me go ahead and talk to the manager over there. And we talked, we hit it off. It was pretty cool talking about Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, yeah, can you draw? Yes. Okay, cool. We'll see you in 2 weeks. And I'm like, oh, sweet. I hope all interviews for a revisionist go this way.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And I feel like I've not heard a story like that before, so that's really cool.
Yeah, that's why I feel like super blessed that my career has gone this way, because with stop motion, it's such a beautiful blend of animation and live action. So I feel like someone has blessed me in allowing me to like ease in this way and then, you know, gently nudge me into 2D. And then now I'm in 3D and done VR. And especially with such a small studio, being able to move up so quickly to try to match with what my skill sets was at the time, but also the opportunity to also jump over to the artistic side as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love what you said about, yeah, I'll try that. And I just love that as like a motto for life. Like, let's try that. Let's try that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm very much, I can learn, I love learning trial by fire. I won't say love. Okay, I take that back. I don't love learning trial by fire, but that is how I learn the best, whether the fire is there and I'm diving in or whether I set the fire myself. I should put that on my profile.
I think so. That's like really good. I think you should become a writer too, because like some of the stuff that you've said, I'm just like, this is so eloquent. This is beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I am working on a fan fiction, so, and it's NaNoWriMo right now. I haven't done anything, but.
But you're thinking about it, and that's important too.
I wrote before this, so let's just call it, you know, I got a head start. It's yes. A weekend to November. It's fine.
Yeah. Okay. I can't wait to read your fan fiction when you're done. Oh, by boy. The way, <Thank you. laughs> if you want, if not, it's totally cool. Don't let me freak you out. Okay. All right. So question real quick though, because you're trying so many things, like, have you had like a final goal in mind, or are you still just kind of, do you have a final goal in mind?
Mm-hmm. I don't think I do right now because I'm still learning so much, especially now that I'm working in a CG feature pipeline, and it's just set up so differently from TV. So I'm just like feeling out and just watching people in their roles. Like, how is it for you? I see what meetings you're in and what decisions you're having to make. I don't necessarily have a final goal quite yet, but I know my next move, which has always been super important because people are always like, oh yeah, I'm going to move to Hollywood and I'm going to be the next like Quentin Tarantino or whatever. And I'm like, bro, I just want to make sure I can get a job first. So I'm very much like, let's just think about 1 or 2 steps ahead of where I am now. And then we can worry about the ultimate goal later.
Yeah. I think that's really smart. That's really cool. So like, how did you end up in feature then?
Working at feature, especially Disney feature, has always been a dream of mine. That 6-year-old that saw Eric Goldberg drawing was just like, I want to work for Mickey Mouse. But it was like, it is very blatant that I always wanted to work here. Anyone who's ever talked to me knows that I was aiming for a Disney feature. I actually watch a lot more animated features than I do TV. And the thing I told myself while I was in college still was like, I'm going out to Los Angeles to work in movies. I didn't really think about TV because I wasn't watching TV a lot at the time. And plus, since so much of my career, both in live action and animation at the time, were based in TV, I felt pretty comfortable and familiar with it. And I just wanted to see what it's like to work on a feature, to work on something for 1 or 2 years and it being still the same story, see how that works, especially when it's a vertical studio like ours, where that means we do everything in-house. Like, how does that work rather than having to use a vendor to use our animation?
Mm, yeah. When you were like interviewing and stuff, like, did anyone pull the, because I've been faced with this in interviews with feature before where they're like, but TV's so different, I don't think you'd have the skills to do feature, even though it was literally for a PA position. Like, did you have any of that?
No, my interviewers at Disney, the 3 times that I interviewed, were really open to it. I don't know if that's an anomaly, because I have interviewed at DreamWorks and they didn't talk about my TV, especially live action experience too much. They were just making sure that, you know, I wouldn't be bored for one thing, because in live action, you're always running around and doing crazy things for 13 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do agree that TV and feature pipelines are much different beasts. And I feel like it's just up to you in deciding how you like to work. So that's why I'm very thankful that I've gotten the opportunity to work in both pipelines, because now I can see what it's like, how the skill sets may be different, but boiling down to it, at least in production management, I feel like they're so super similar.
Yeah. I mean, I figured that, like, okay, this is the way I've broken it down in my mind, and I have no idea because I've never worked in feature, but mm-hmm. it just interests me so much the way, like, things get made, you know, mm-hmm. the pipelines. It's so interesting to see mm-hmm. the differences and similarities. But kind of in my mind, what I, like, am kind of assuming, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is that, like, for TV, we have episodes. So instead of episodes, it's all of the scenes in the movie, and you're taking them through every step of the pipeline, but they're all at different steps of the pipeline depending on what they need and any revisions they need. But yeah, that's what in my mind the like tracking system looks like.
Yeah, so instead of episodes, we track by sequences, which is like a bundle of scenes. It's kind of like when you're breaking down a script, it's like the story beats. So yeah, that's correct in the way that they'll write the movie and they'll board out the entire movie, super rough. And then they'll break it down into sequences, and the directors will try to determine which sequences feel the most solid. If this sequence seems pretty good, like they have a complete thought, beginning, middle, and end, they don't feel like it's going to change too much, they'll go ahead and have the boards like refine it, and then it can finally move into production. So we jump around a lot. It can be really confusing.
Whew. So like so you're a production coordinator today in the mm-hmm. environment department, and you've been mm-hmm. in a few departments, which is really cool. But today, like, what does what happens in the environment department, and like, what does a typical day look like for you?
So in environments, what we do is we take the visual development and some of the storyboards, and the artist will put them into Maya or whatever program that they're using and put them into a 3D space. And then once something is created, whether that's a set or a prop, that'll move into the look development department, which is where they put like the texture and the color onto things. It's really cool because then something goes from being like a gray blob into a beautiful porcelain vase. Like, that's absolutely insane how they do that. And a third part of the environments department, at least at Disney, is set extension, which is also known as matte painting. But the reason they call it set extension is that at Disney, they do a little bit of 3D modeling in addition to its projection. So it's not just painting, but it's so much more than that. And so my typical days when we're ramping down right now, but back when we weren't ramping down, it was a matter of opening up Shotgun, which is a production management tracking, data tracking software, for those who don't know, and just seeing the state of the things that are in work, whether that is a shot that we have to address because we have to like set dress specifically for the shot, or the state of a set or a prop or a sky slash background for a set extension. And then making sure the artists are ready to show it to the production designers for approval, and making sure that the thing that we created also plays well with the other departments. Like, is it big enough for an animation so that a character can actually hold this vase? Does it have to break? If it has to break, is it ready to be broken by our friends in effects and all that? So it's a lot of, hey, we made a thing. Cool. Well, you didn't make it the way we need you to make it. Can you remake it or add a thing to it? And it's like, absolutely. Of course. My goodness.
So, like, do you, as the coordinator, have to, like, read through every draft of the script to make sure, like, nothing was added in terms, and as well as the animatic, like, just any changes that happen?
With the script breakdown, that usually relies on the production supervisor as well as the department supervisors, because then they're the ones who think about what artists can do it and about how long it'll take. But we do have a process in which almost anyone can look through the animatic of a scene, and they'll call out like rip props, sets, and characters might be there. So I don't actually do a lot of the actual reading of scripts or storyboards unless I need to fill in for my supervisor. But it's a lot of just tracking the state of things, like the state of environments, and then making sure that the dates are lining up with the other departments that are dependent upon us, and seeing if something needs to be adjusted, if something can be backfilled or needs to be flagged to the higher ups and for like a real grown up to take care of.
So how have you cultivated like your management skills as you've transitioned from assistant to coordinator?
The biggest difference between being a PA and a coordinator, I feel, is that as a coordinator, things can be your fault, which is like a really blunt way of saying that you do have a lot more responsibilities, and that the way you work has an effect on the pipeline and on other people's schedules. Because at least in my experience as a PA, you are very reactionary. People are just like, hey, we need help doing this, or they'll put things on you and you're there to catch it and make sure it doesn't fall. Whereas with being a coordinator, you have to look to see what is going to be thrown at you or what could be thrown at you, if that makes sense. And if you're not prepared to catch that ball, it's going to get dropped. And then suddenly you have to readjust 1, 2, 3, 10 things because you just missed one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Mm-hmm. Such a perfect like soundbite way of saying it too.
Thanks. I like metaphors.
So good. So like, what does, so like in asking the last question, like, I feel like, you know, you don't think that you need management skills until like you're a manager, but you do kind of, even as a PA, you manage stuff, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. though you are more reactionary, but like mm-hmm. through all of these, work environments that you've been in, like, what have you kind of defined as good leadership to you? Like, what does good leadership look like to you?
My favorite leaders are the ones who will get in there and actually do the work with you, that will hold your hand through it, because it can be a really daunting process no matter where you are in your career and how many times you've done it. Another one I know that I've seen that I really, really appreciate is that if something for some reason didn't work out well or was wrong, the leadership will take it upon themselves to be like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and take the brunt of this because I did not interpret what you were looking for correctly. And it was up to me to make sure that my team was on the right path. But if something goes really, really well, like a director loves what they're seeing, the leader will be like, yeah, absolutely. I did nothing. That was X, Y, and Z artists. They are fantastic. So they won't take the credit for other people's work, even if they did have a heavy hand in it, but they also celebrate their team, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And also, I really love humble leaders that are willing to be proven wrong, because they're a leader because they have so much experience, they know what they're doing, presumably, but they're always open to conversation on how to be better, whether it's the department they're working on or themselves as a leader. And if they think of something, but they're open to having people give them constructive criticism and being like, well, you know what? Okay, let's go ahead and do it your way. And I would love to be proven wrong in this. And if it works out, that is going to be amazing. So I just love a really flexible and open leader like that.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you are an artist and have worked as a storyboard artist. So like, are you wanting to pivot back to the art side eventually? Or like, what's the goal or strategy to get there, if so?
Mm-hmm. Like I said before, I usually know what my next step is going to be. And for me, I feel like I really want to get back into storyboarding or revising. The reason being because at Disney, we have this amazing opportunity where, or at least I did, with working closely with the directors in the layout department, because we go to edit with them as well. And in edit, they're working out like kinks in the story, and it's just fascinating to watch them do this. And just seeing Jen Lee like take ownership of Frozen 2 and just like admit when there is a piece of writing that is not turning out well and she can own that is phenomenal. And another opportunity that we had that was my like break, not my breaking point, but like the minute something in me clicked, was that we had a screening for Frozen 2 and they gave us the opportunity to give notes. And I'm just like, what, you want notes from everyone? That's okay, well, here we go. And one of the notes I gave was that for Anna's song at the end of the movie where she's singing about the next right thing, one of the lyrics is, there's a voice inside my head that's telling me to do the next right thing. And I'm like, what is that voice? Is that Anna's voice? Is that Elsa? Is that her mom? And I wrote that down saying that Anna needs to kind of essentially earn that song because we don't know who is this thing that's telling her to keep moving forward. And the next thing we know, the next time we see a screening, there is the troll grandfather, Grandpappy, that tells the girls like, when you can't see the future, all you can do is the next right thing. And I'm just like, oh my God, that's my note. And I'm not saying like I was the only person to have this note, but the fact that I had that kind of story sense, I suggested it and it was implemented, even if it was amongst like a bunch of other people, the fact that I had that thought and it was good enough to get into the final movie, I was just like, I think I got some story chops. So that's when I was like, yeah, I got to get back into this. This is amazing.
Oh, I love that. That is.
You're welcome, you guys.
Yeah, that is so good. yeah, oh, that's so good. Okay, so do you feel like having worked in production on layout and editorial teams have influenced the way that you approach storyboarding now?
It has, in that because in layout, I know so much more about camera and what's possible in camera, which is basically everything. But just being exposed to those images has really changed the way I board because I'm a mostly self-taught artist. I've taken a few classes and I've gone through a mentorship, but it's like, you know, I directed my own education. I had to seek out what I didn't know and get that. But just being around that has really influenced me to be, or try to be, more cinematic. I have different ways of problem solving. And I promise, I swear, if and when I become a storyboard artist, I will indicate as much background as possible. Layout and environments will love it.
I will have to say, yeah, it's, I don't know. Backgrounds are such a bee, and if you can do them, that's awesome.
I can't draw a background, but I will at least put a door somewhere so you can see scale, and where in the room they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your production team and everyone else will love you for it.
It's going to be great. I'm going to be the most communicative storyboard artist ever.
Yeah. Throughout the industry, this is quite a hot topic about like the additional work that falls on storyboarders, like timing and nearly animating your boards. And maybe this is more about TV, but I'm just kind of curious as a storyboarder, like, how do you feel about these things?
I hate that it's become an expectation, because I do agree that that's a lot, especially since timetables have gotten smaller and crunchier for TV. While I personally, the way I learned storyboard revising, like on my first show, the artist that I would revise for did that thing where like at the end of the panel, they would deform the character just a bit to add like just a smidge of secondary animation or follow through. And I thought that was super cool because it made it really fun to like click through it. But I know that's not a thing that should be standard, and I have been told repeatedly to stop. So while I enjoy it, and I have done timing as well for as a revisionist, and I really like timing to shorts, but it did take a lot of extra time. And I agree that it shouldn't be expected if it's not within our pay grade, within the job description, and if there is not adequate times. Like, you can't have all three of those. Something has to give. If I'm going to be expected to revise as well as time it, you're going to pay me as a revisionist timer with enough time in the schedule to do so, because I'm not going to be able to revise and time within 4 weeks, because that is not quantumly, is that even a word?
I've never heard the phrase revisionist timer. Is that a role?
It was just what was expected in the position that I was in. I was revising / PA on a small show. And yeah, we were responsible for recording Scratch, which I really, really enjoy. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard for me to answer it because I like timing and I like that little extra bit of animation. I can't animate. But it's like, well, if that's what's killing all of my colleagues, if it's not what is being paid for by the union and is not within... if I'm not being paid to do as such and it's not my job description, then I agree you don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're making that decision for your coworkers and for colleagues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause despite me liking it and will do it for my own work, but it's just like knowing the difference between work and fun is really important to me and is something that I've had to come to grips with the whole like, well, it's just an extra 5 minutes. I don't need to charge an extra 5 minutes. I'm like, no. You charge the extra 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love
that. It comes out to be like 20 cents. It's like, it doesn't matter. It's the principle of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So glad you brought that up. So what is the best thing about working in animation?
What I really love is that almost anything is possible. Like, you are not bound by physics, you're just literally bound by technology. And I love that either the technology is working to catch up with people's craziest animation dreams, or they're being inspired by the other crazy technology that's coming out, especially with things like VR and AR is phenomenal. And I just, because of things are so possible in live action, if you needed a fork, you would either have to go to IKEA or Target to see what forks were available that someone had already created, or you'd have to like go through the process of somehow creating your own fork. I don't know how to do that unless I were to become a metalsmith or something. Whereas in animation, it was just like, okay, make a fork. Well, what kind of fork? And you get to ask so many questions like, well, is it going to have like a filigree? How many tines is it going to have? How big is it going to be? So I just love that, you know, you can do anything.
Mm-hmm. So like, I didn't send you any questions ahead of time about this, but like, I didn't know that you'd worked in VR and AR. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like, that's so exciting.
Yeah. Between Frozen 2 and my show Raya Now, I got to work on Myth, the VR experience, A Frozen Tale. And that was super, super fun because it was done in Unity. I think I can say this. It was done in Unity, which is normally a game engine. And what's so great about it is that multiple people can work on it at the same time. And you just have to check it out and check it back in, kind of like a library book. And then suddenly, like, this thing has everything that all the changes that you've implemented, you can do changes in real time with the director or production designer sitting right there and you can see it happen. So it expedites the process. And like one of the favorite things that I love to do was that when we had notes on a scene or something, I could actually open up Unity, go through the scene, like click through it, and I could click on like the fireplace and attach a note to it. And if you walk through the scene, you'll see my little note like pop up. And if you turn around and you like see a rock or a flower, it would have another note to pop up. And I'm just like, I'm putting notes inside a scene. I'm like totally an artist right now. This is so cool.
That is really cool.
Yeah, it was amazing. And just like taking into consideration the thing, like how do you build a pipeline for VR? I have no idea.
You're blowing my mind with all these questions that need to be answered. Oh my gosh. That's so cool. I'll have to check that out. So like, what's your reaction when you realize your show or your contract is about to end and you're going to receive your end date?
Back in TV, when it was very much like, here's your end date and you don't know if you're staying at the studio, it was nerve-wracking in the sense that it's like, well, am I about to be unemployed? Should I like start looking at this? Because to try to mitigate that, what I try to do is to ask if there is anything that's going to be opening up afterwards, or if I should anticipate taking a break. Do I need to go on unemployment? Can you tell me this, please? So again, it's just like trying to prepare for the potential of being unemployed for some time. And when the date comes and if nothing's binding, it's just like, well, you know what? It's just not the right time. I have faith that I did a good job in this and that they'll ask me back whenever they have something, as long as I keep in touch with them. At the time as well, I also had the good fortune of being a background extra in live action shows as my fallback, because it was a great way to just like fill in the time between jobs. And it was fun. It pays terribly, but it's so much fun to just, you know, go on set and just be paid to sit around and then walk in front of camera for 30 seconds.
That is really cool. Like, how did you get into that? Just in case someone needs something right now, or, you know, when Hollywood opens back up and everything.
Oh, man. That's something that I'm so sad for the folks right now, that being an extra isn't too viable. I know it's happening, but it's just like, it's so such a small niche right now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the way I got into it was that back in St. Louis, when I was in school and I took the acting for the camera class, the teacher said, like, when you go out to LA, the first thing you need to do is register to be an extra. And I'm just like, oh my God, that's just a thing. You can just register. You don't have to be cast or audition for it. You just have to look like a person. That's amazing. And I got into it when I was between live action shows, because there was a span for about like, for 8 months in which I did not get a live action gig for whatever reason. And I became a full-time background extra, and it just became my go-to because it was so easy to just pick up. It's essentially like a gig, even though you are put onto a payroll. It was just like, hey, I'm available on these days. And if they have something for which they need someone that looks like me, they'll just like text me and be like, hey, are you available? I'm like, heck yeah, I am. And then I just show up on set looking like, a young adult Asian American female.
Yeah, I feel like things like that, or like temp jobs, like that can really help people like make that transition from like wherever they're coming from, if they want to live here or New York or even Atlanta. Like these are good jobs to just get here, because it seems like it's easier to get work once you're here. Was that true for you?
It was, in the sense that, so here's the advice that I always give someone who needs to move in order to make it into industry, is that while you're in school, if you need a job, get yourself a retail job at a national chain, whether that's like Applebee's or Target or Best Buy. So that way, when you're ready to move, you can put in a request to be transferred out here, which is what my husband Max did with being a barista at Barnes & Noble. He worked at Barnes & Noble in St. Louis for about a year, year and a half. And when it was time for us to move, he requested to be transferred over to the Barnes & Noble at the Grove, which he landed there, and he had a job waiting for him like the day we got here, which was amazing and very nerve settling. So that was great. Mm-hmm. And he was able to, like, you know, charm the management enough to be like, hey, you should look at my girlfriend, Ashley. She needs a job. And I'm like, okay, we'll take her on. So I always say, try to get a national chain retail job. It's going to be your day job. It'll fuel you to continue pursuing your dreams because you don't want to be there forever, presumably. If you do, that's totally cool. That's fine. Changing dreams is all good. Mm-hmm. But it'll at least, you know, settle down the hard part of how am I going to sustain myself out here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also be an extra if coronavirus goes away and it's okay and you feel safe doing so.
Yeah, this is all such good advice. Okay, so in production, there's not always an opportunity to have our voices heard in terms of like showcasing the spectrum of people and stories. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of reacting to what we're being given by creative. So like, have you found a way to exercise positive influence over what you're working on? Kind of like in the way you had given that note on Frozen 2. But I'm wondering if there's any, like, how are you able to influence your artistic co-workers to keep inclusivity in mind?
Mm-hmm. Fortunately, because production management at Disney works so closely with the creative leadership for which they are responsible for managing, it's really easy to have a casual rapport with them to be like, oh, that was an interesting meeting in which we saw this visual development and this, or you went ahead and did this without, as far as I know, any real information about whatever the thing is. Like, did you consider blah, blah, blah? Does that take into consideration this thing? And so that's the way I try to do it, is to try to be gentle about it, because I myself am not an authority on much of anything, but I do know a few things here and there. And what I learned about my time on Let's Go Luna, which is a children's show, an educational children's show about a troop of kids that travel around the world, was just posing a question to Joe, our director, who was really, really good about like asking all the right questions and being respectful of cultures. Just posing it as a conversation, because I don't doubt that he didn't think about something this, but I just want to confirm for myself to just be another voice. Like, you did consider this. Yes, you did. Fantastic. You're doing great. And in that way, I was able to help inform a little bit of like the episodes in Thailand and a little bit of Germany, because I had just traveled there. And that goes back to having a really good leader that is open to having conversations, that just because they're a leader doesn't mean they don't have to listen to anyone. It's that they are willing to listen and also implement what they're hearing.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, I always felt like asking questions mm-hmm. in a very thoughtful manner was the best way to go. Yeah, I love that.
And I'm very much the kind of person, like, when I'm anxious about something, like, if I'm seeing something that I feel is wrong or just needs to be addressed, the way I deal with it is that I just attack it and just, like, will bluntly ask, like, that's wrong, or, like, did you do blah, blah, blah? And the worst thing that'll happen is, like, they'll yell back at me or something's like, well, I can't be responsible for how they'd react, but I am responsible for myself in being, like, I can't stand to see this, or this is freaking me out. Let's talk about this. You don't want to talk? Okay, that's fine. I at least tried, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. At least try. That's my fortune cookie.
So how about, same question, but when you're storyboarding?
Mm-hmm. The storyboarding, I'm actually still trying to figure out, because I'm still trying to find like what makes my voice, because I do want to be more inclusive in my stories, even if it's something as maybe simple, it may not be simple, as having a left-handed character rather than a right-handed character. How can I incorporate more BIPOC into my stories without them being tokenized and being truthful and respectful, you know, because I just don't want to put them there as set dressing. I want them to have a purpose, but what steps do I need to take in order for them to not, you know, justify who they are, but to make sure that I'm portraying them authentically and truthfully through my story. So it's still something I'm working through.
Mm-hmm. What is BIPOC?
It is Black Indigenous People of Color.
Oh, I kept seeing, I always, since like that started popping up, I thought it was mm-hmm. Black People of Color this entire time.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's a bit more inclusive because Black and Indigenous communities have been disproportionately affected by, you know, racial transgressions and everything. So it was important to also mention them separately in front of just, instead of just people of color, because that is a bit too generic.
Yeah. I love that you brought that up and that you didn't roast me for not knowing. Thank you. Well, we're all doing the best we can and learning as we go.
Exactly. So why should anyone be yelled at for that?
Yeah. So what do you want to see more of in TV and film?
More of that BIPOC representation would be fantastic. What I would like to see more in TV or just entertainment in general is not only BIPOC stories or cultural neurodivergent and like physical diversities that are about just struggle and trauma. Like, I do believe those stories have to be told. We have to see them, but also give them the opportunity to just be them, their normal selves, you know, because that was something that I struggled with a lot when I first moved here. And when I wanted to try to tell stories and they said, oh yeah, we want to go ahead and get like really racially diverse storytellers, and the prompts they would give or the stories they were looking for, it's just like, tell us about how hard it is to be an Asian American in modern America. I'm like, that wasn't really my experience, so I guess I'm not Asian enough for you. But if you just want a story about how I was 10 years old and obsessed with Pokemon in the middle of like really suburban Salt Lake City, Utah, I can do that, but I can't tell you what it's like to have like a tomato thrown at my face. So I want those people to have the opportunity to just be portrayed as normal, because I remember when Bridesmaids came out and everyone was like, look at all these women trying to act and be funny like men. And I'm just like, you obviously don't know a lot of women in your life, because this is how women actually act. It's just the first time you're seeing it on screen without men attached to it. So it's just like, you know what? It's there. We want to see it.
Fully agree. I love everything you're saying, and you do need more of that. I felt like in college, like, animation was like this kind of, I hate this phrase, but the redheaded stepchild, like this, like everyone called it that. It was just a small little department next to this huge film department, and the film department got everything, it felt like. But the stories that they really just like loved their students to make were like these really depressing, like introspection stories where nothing really happened. And at least that's all the short films I saw. Like, maybe there are other things. So like, there's a place for those stories, don't get me wrong. But I feel like, I would love to see more normal stories of a different variety of people just having their experiences.
I saw something on Twitter literally like 2 days ago where someone was talking about how with animation, it's, or not with animation specifically, but in order for something to be called mature, it has to be about trauma, it has to be about struggle, it has to be about this super terrible thing and how you do or do not survive it. And they were just saying, why is it that a happy story is not considered mature? Like, happiness is not a childish prospect. Happiness can be mature. Happiness can be complicated. Kind of like what we saw in Inside Out. It's tinged with all these different emotions and different flavors. And it's like, why is this relegated to just kids' shows? Why is animation just relegated to either being super fun, bubbly stuff, or it has to be like gross out humor and super nasty? Like, why can't we have animation for adults or just in general that's like slice of life? Things are happy, things are cool, we chill. It's not like, you know, guns a blazing everywhere, or it's not like, I'm trying to bake a cake, can you help me?
I agree. So we did this series of like anime discussion topics, and I learned that, you know, in Japan, like anime, there's like different types of anime, and there's like dramatic ones and more mature and like not like goofy, childish or zany ones. And I thought that was so cool that they have all these genres within their animation. And yeah, I want that so bad for us. And I hope that with streamers, like, they will start to see that opportunity, because I feel like there are a lot of us that want to tell those kind of stories.
That's something that I would love to learn, how to develop a show, because while I don't think or want currently to be a showrunner, but it's like, if I get the idea and then opportunity to produce an adult animated show where it's just like normal adults doing cool, normal adult things, that'd be so cool.
Yeah. Okay. How do you believe we can be better allies in the workplace?
For me, it's if you feel safe in doing so, please, please just say something. If it's not to the entire room, reach out to someone, whether you're the person who's being affected or if you see someone else being affected, just let them know you're there. Don't feel like you have to come in kicking down the doors and be Joan of Arc and just like annihilate all people who have terrible, terrible opinions. But just like do a Mr. Rogers and focus on the people who are doing good things or who can benefit from your help and just be available is like all that I can really ask of anyone, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. So let's talk about self-care. Like, do you have a work-life balance?
I do because I feel like I'm really good at compartmentalizing. my commute to work has always been at least an hour. So that's a really good like wind down time to just leave work behind. But it's also very much the thing where as much as I love my job won't love me back. And if I'm thinking about it while I'm at home, or if I think I'm going to log in for 10 minutes to just do a thing and they're not going to pay me, no one's going to thank me for that. I mean, well, someone probably will thank me because my partners in production management are amazing, but they are not the ones who are going to pay me. The payroll will not reflect that 10 minutes unless I log it in and it's already been approved. But another thing that what was told to me in my Women in Animation mentorship circle is that instead of looking at it as work-life balance, look at it as work-life choices, because most of the time we have the choice to log in on a Saturday for 10 minutes to click off these things so things will be better prepared for Monday. We have the choice to be like, I need to leave at 6 because there's a show I need to catch. I need to go take care of my kid. My kid has a soccer game or something. Everyone can make these choices. And if you state it as such, I feel, at least in my experience and in what I've seen, 95% of the time, it is not a problem because what we do doesn't immediately change the world, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really eye-opening. I like that, like, making it choices instead of, like, solid boundaries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Angelique Yen over at Nickelodeon for that.
How else do you self-care?
I really allow myself to indulge myself in whatever it is that I want to do. Because like if I'm having a tough day and I just really feel like I need to do something for myself, whether it's like to go impulse buy a video game or something, because it'll make me happy, even if it's for just 15 minutes, at least I did that for myself. I just want to make sure that I myself can be happy and cozy because I can do that for myself because that is within my power. Or if I just need to go crazy and I need to stress eat a pizza, even though I don't have a lactaid pill and it's going to kill me later. It's just like what I needed to do in that moment, you know, because I know I'll come out okay. I'll pay the consequences, but I'm already in pain. So it's just like, Ashley, what do you feel like doing? I feel like dying right now with some cheese.
Oh my God, Ashley.
I know, it's mayhem over here. Again, like I said, whether I learn trial by fire by going in or causing it myself.
Yeah. I love it. Okay, let's celebrate what inspires you. Like, what inspires you right now?
Right now, it's Greek mythology because I accidentally got back into it this summer with reading Madeline Miller's book, Song of Achilles and Circe, which is phenomenal. If you're into modern Greek, well, it's not modern, but into updated language, Greek mythology, highly recommend those. And then going off of that, my friend Ava got me into Lore Olympus on Webtoons, which is so good if you like romance, and it is so angsty. Right. And on top of that is this new video game called Hades, which I'm playing on the Switch, which deals with you being the prince of hell, you know, of being the son of Hades and trying to escape him is just like, oh, my brain is like on fire right now with so much Greek mythology.
That is so cool.
And what's great is that Lore Olympus is made by a woman. Song of Achilles and Circe is written by a woman. And Hades is by a small publisher called Supergiant Games. So it's like you're supporting small businesses with loving all these things, you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing I've done the past like few months, like I'm not going out and doing things or eating out or anything, so like I've been able to save a little money, and I'm like, every time I want to buy something, I keep remembering that if I buy something from like an artist or like mm-hmm. a small like business, it's like it's supporting them as well. Like, so I'm trying mm-hmm. to be going out of my way to support small businesses and artists and yeah. stuff like that. So like I think that's so cool that yeah, that you've thought that all of these things that inspire you are very helpful to our ecosystem as well.
Yes, yes. Amazon is going to be fine without me.
Yes, definitely. Do you have like a favorite story like that's just stuck with you for years?
It's not been years, but the story of Achilles and Patroclus as demonstrated in Song of Achilles is like really haunting me. The relationship, okay, it's been a little over a year, so maybe we can call it years plural, but in Breath of the Wild, Legend of Zelda, there is a storyline, spoiler alert, in which it is canon that Zelda has romantic feelings for Link, and then you just think about how their lives have ended and how they've changed in the video game, and you, like, she's been waiting 100 years for this boy to wake the fuck up, but he doesn't have any memories, so he has, like, the weight of his past that he doesn't remember weighing on him. Just after waking up, I was like, I don't even know if he knows his own name. He doesn't know what a stick is when he first wakes up. And he has, like, this ghost and this talking castle being like, hey, you have to save me. And he's just like, I'm in my underwear. What are you talking about? And just like, how do you reconcile having to go through your hero's journey 100 years before, waking up, and having to do it again? Sorry, I love Breath of the Wild so much.
Me too. I'm actually replaying it because I love it so much. It's just,
I'm going to do so that calming. Soon. Yeah. I'm going to do that soon, probably. I might stream it because
oh, please
wonderful
do.
And terrible things have come out of my mouth while yelling at Link. But I have to play through, what do you call it, Age of Calamity first. Also, that mm-hmm. fanfic I talked about earlier this episode, that's what I'm writing it for. Oh, it's for yes. Breath of the Wild.
That makes me so happy. Like, okay, and I'm so excited that you were thinking about streaming it because, like, you are so funny. I just have to tell everybody that, like, so before COVID happened and the shutdown happened, we were literally rehearsing for a sketch show at Second City for my mm-hmm. directing program I'm in. And you're just freaking hilarious. You and Max both. And, like, the stuff we come up with is so good together. And, yeah, I want you to start your YouTube channel and start streaming because, like, I want to watch it all. So,
okay, perfect.
Oh, just for me.
Man. Yes, no, I'll do it. I'll call it the Cassie stream.
That'll oh, my it. God, don't do that. It's the Ashley stream.
Ashley stream for Cassie. How about
that? Okay, that works. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay, so final advice. Mm-hmm. For creative folks who want to do what you do, like, what are some best resources you've encountered?
Okay, best resources is kind of going off the vein of Twitter because I think it's kind of cooled down in the last 5 years, but still is reaching out to people and treating them as humans. Like, for me, when people reach out to me on LinkedIn, if they don't include a note with it, I will not respond. Or if I have not met, or if I've met you, I'll accept. But if you have a note because you see me as a person, not just because I had a fancy title at a really big studio, I will talk to you. So when you're talking to people, do a little bit of research, treat them as a human, say hello. That makes sense. If they don't respond, oh, I'm sorry, but you know, someone will respond. I'll respond if you include a note.
Yeah, I agree. That's pretty mm-hmm. much what I do too. What I try okay. to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So,
but I have a few more tidbits of advice that I always give people.
Great.
One thing, let's see, I talked about how dreams can change. Just be aware of that. Just remember that you yourself are your own driver in life, or at least you can be as influential of a driver as possible, because the way I see school and life after school is kind of like if you're an astronaut, and you're studying up to, you know, pilot this spaceship into space, because if you don't, you'll explode. So once you graduate, that's when your rocket ship bursts through the Earth's gravitational pull, and you're finally just floating in space, and you feel like, ah, I finally made it. I escaped Earth. I graduated from school. But what could end up happening is that you can float in space endlessly. There's nothing for you to do. After you graduate, if you think just having a degree in your hand will open up all the doors for you, you'll probably be wrong. So it's up to you as the astronaut of your life shuttle to turn on those thrusters and actually go somewhere. If that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. I love that so much.
Be an astronaut, as told to you by Ashley Lamb.
I love this. I love all of this. I hope everyone feels empowered after hearing this episode, because you landed some really great thoughts and ideals and motivation. So, like, where can people follow you online?
I am on Twitter and Instagram at Hello Ashley Lamb. My storyboard portfolio can be seen at ashleylambstory.com. You're welcome to try to find me on LinkedIn. And if you want to send me a message, I'm happy to answer questions there or on my Instagram or Twitter for like my 5 human followers on either platform. But I'm real. I'm a human. I love talking to people, especially students who are so excited. I love talking to excited people. So come at me. Be excited, because I'll be excited at you as well.
She's not lying. She's so excited. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fantastic.
Thank you, Cassie. I'm so happy to be here. I'm going to check this off my bullet journal list of things accomplished.
I love that, because I am going to check this off of my bullet journal list too. Oh my God. Okay, and then I will edit it there, because that's so cute and silly.
I also wanted to plug Rise Up Animation, for which I'm a mentor. It's a volunteer group of working animation professionals across all disciplines that connects us with BIPOC folks that are looking to get some eyes on their resume, on their portfolios, and do informational interviews and maybe even mock interviews if you're looking for that, and to just be your connection to the industry. Be sure to check them out on Instagram at Rise Up Animation and keep an eye on their monthly signups to get connected.
The Ink and Paint Folk podcast is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by year 2025. Learn more at womeninanimation.org. Please also check out other great organizations and groups promoting diversity in the industry. Black and Animated, Rise Up Animation, Latinx in Animation, Asian Queens in Animation, and Diverse Tunes. This episode was produced by me, with the magic of the internet, from beautiful Burbank, California. Music by Grace Tsai and TV's Kyle. Edited by Mae Murphy. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast. Stay colorful.